Jurassic World Camp Cretaceous recently thundered its way onto Netflix. The animated show's first season provided fans of the Jurassic franchise a deeper look into the park created for Jurassic World before and during the unfortunate rampage of the Indominus Rex. The reception of the show was resoundingly positive, and one of the great features was the music score composed by Leo Bierenberg. Leo has already showcased his talents by composing music for shows like Kung Fu Panda, The Paws of Destiny on Amazon, Pen 15 on Hulu, and Cobra Kai on Netflix. He has also provided additional music for such films as Ant-Man, Edge of Tomorrow, and Frozen. Now, he brings his unique voice into the Jurassic world. Derek Davis had a wonderful conversation with Leo that focused on his fantastic score for Camp Cretaceous. But, fair warning, there are spoilers revealed for those that have not yet watched the show's first season. With that out of the way, Jurassic Time presents an introspective look into the process of crafting a prehistoric score 65 million years in the making.
So I've seen the entire show, of course, day one.
Oh, great. What do you think?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. I mean,
yeah, it's pretty special.
How did your interest and career in music begin, and how did it lead to Jurassic World Camp Cretaceous?
The short answer is I was like the band geek kid in high school. But how that kind of ends up in Jurassic Park is before that, when I was like a little kid, I was obsessed with dinosaurs, like knew when I was 3, 4, 5, like knew every single thing there was to know about dinosaurs, not unlike Darius in Camp Cretaceous. However, like all my data is out of date now. At some point I stopped being interested in dinosaurs and, you know, they've kind of changed the entire scientific basis for a lot of that. But I was crazy into dinosaurs, so when Jurassic Park came out in what, 93?
Yeah.
I didn't see it in theaters because I was pretty young, so my parents wouldn't let me see it. But I saw it like as soon as it came out on video. I was like obsessed with it. Had all these Jurassic Park toys. And like when I was that age, like, you know, 5 to 10, like I pretty much just wanted to be Steven Spielberg. Like that was my goal in life. I would make movies with my friends on a handheld digital camera, and like even a few years after that, and like this was like iMovie, you know, version one generation. So
yeah,
you know, we were like we were getting really fancy with some stuff, and that was just like a huge interest of mine. But as I aged, I became the band geek. I played saxophone and clarinet and flute. I studied voice. I did a lot of musical theater. And that basically defined my high school life. And as I was, you know, thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, I started to enjoy like playing the saxophone less and looking at the inner workings of the music I was playing more. So, you know, I would start by like transcribing something for my jazz band that I had like heard, and then like have them play it, and like, you know, would start by like hearing a tune and then like arranging it. A lot of it was jazz based because that was like kind of my big passion. And coming, you know, as I was ending high school, I kind of just was like, hey, I think I want to like study this music thing, like this like theory and composition thing. So I ended up going to NYU to study music theory and composition, and NYU has an amazing film school. My roommate freshman year, who's still one of my best friends, was a film major, and so like I kind of immediately started writing music for all of his movies, which was something that I think I like thought I had wanted to do because like I liked film scores a lot, but like I never like actually tried it before, like knew that was like a thing I could do. Well, so like that, I got really into that in during my undergrad at NYU, and I ended up going to a graduate program at USC. So that brought me out to LA, and through that met some people and met some people and got introduced to the composer Christoph Beck, who I then worked for, you know, 5 years, and that's where I did some of those additional music credits. At that point, I was just like a working composer, and one thing leads to another, and I had demoed for that Kung Fu Panda show and got it. So I did that in like 2018. It's an awesome show for anyone who hasn't checked it out. Like, it's so fun. If you like the Kung Fu Panda movies, it's very much like a nice extension of that universe.
Very cool.
With a lot of the original characters, and like it was just like really fun to I've done a lot of shows that involve kind of like diving into an existing universe and like expanding it greatly, like Camp Cretaceous, and that was a really fun one. So I knew the whole team over at DreamWorks Animation, who eventually made Camp Cretaceous, but the way that came about, it's the most like Hollywood story ever, I feel like, because and I consider myself very fortunate, but the composer community is like pretty small. Everyone kind of knows everyone, and so I know Michael Giacchino, and when they were starting to think about like Camp Cretaceous, it had been in production for a year and a half, and they were thinking about like, hey, who's gonna score this? They called Michael and they said like, hey, like, do you want to score this? Do you know someone who you think would be good for this? And he knew that I was doing this Kung Fu Panda show for DreamWorks at the time, and he was like, oh, why don't you just ask Leo to do it? It's like right up his alley.
Wow.
And then and so it sort of meant like, you know, the Universal people and the DreamWorks people then being like, oh yeah, we use Leon Kung Fu Panda, like this is great. And then, you know, there's like a process to like, I met the team and like, you know, had a bunch of preliminary creative conversations. And then suddenly I was the guy. So that, for which I am eternally grateful to Michael, thank you. So yeah, that's 5-year-old me up to Camp Cretaceous in about 3 minutes.
Wow, well, it's pretty good. Pretty good enrichment. No, that's fantastic. And that's really cool that Michael was able to just flat out recommend you like that, almost on a whim, it seems like. I mean, that's really nice.
Yeah, it was cool. Like I said, it was pretty Hollywood. But it's not, I like that because like, it meant like, as I was getting started, I could like, you know, chat with him a little bit about like, hey, it's Jurassic Park. Like, not many people touch this. Basically just like John Williams and you. And yeah. I guess, who did Jurassic Park 3? Don Davis, I think?
Yeah, it was. Don Davis, yeah.
Yeah, so that's some pretty hallowed company that I'm in. You know, it's intimidating, let's put it that way.
I can only imagine. Part of the process of your score was to adapt to the original themes, of course, of John Williams and Michael Giacchino. How were you able to adapt that into the voice of your own material?
I like to say like I'm pretty stingy with those themes. If you go through the show, so like when we spot the show, you know, every episode we kind of sit down, me and the showrunners, Scott and Aaron, and discuss, you know, go top to bottom and discuss the episode and talk about what we want the music to do. And there's really only a few times in this first season where we use the Jurassic Park theme, but or like one of the various Jurassic Park themes. There's a few that I like to draw on, and I'll go into that.
Yeah.
and I like, for me, what I didn't want to do is just use them because we can use them, because that it feels almost too much like fan service if you just like slap it everywhere. So for me, it was really important to be like, if we use it, is it gonna pack the most emotional punch and like really make people feel like this is that Jurassic Park moment I've been waiting for, like the big climax. And so obviously the first episode, we draw on them a lot. We use the Journey to the Island theme when they're first entering the park. We use like the main theme when the kids are going over the zip line in that spectacular looking sequence with the dinosaur herd. And then the other one that I like to use is the raptor theme.
Yes.
Mostly because people don't get, like, I would say, unless you're like a Jurassic Park fan, you don't actually know what that is.
Yeah.
And it really gets into like a part of the John Williams score that I think casual fans don't realize quite as much, which is that like it's a monster movie, and he's got just like this awesome, complex, like, you know, really dissonant music in a lot of the movie. Like, if it, most of the score is really that, it's not bah, bah, da, bah, bah, da, bah, bah, bah. That is kind of reserved for a couple glorious moments, and so, you know, we don't see the raptors a lot in Camp Cretaceous, but in that first episode we do a little bit, both in the video game intro and at the end of the episode when they're in the raptor pit. And so like,
yeah,
that was that's probably the one that's the most fun for me to use when I get to use it, because it's like, because no one actually recognizes it. So
you
can really like mess around with it, and it feels, it almost feels like more of a fluent Jurassic Park score when I get to sneak that in there.
Yes.
But for the other ones, you know, it's about only using it when, and they sort of leave it up to me if I want to use it and when I want to use it. And so for me, it's just important that, like, if I'm the audience, when would I want to hear that? And, you know, Journey to the Island, which is personally my favorite of the various Jurassic Park motifs.
Mine too. Yeah.
I feel like it's everyone's favorite. I think I once like made a joke early on in the process where I was like, yeah, there's the main theme and then there's the theme that everyone likes. And like, those are the two, because like, you know, no one knows it's called Journey to the Island. They just think, like, yeah, bah, bah, bah. You know, so we use that in that first episode in the gate, and we use it in the gyrosphere herding for just kind of for a minute.
Yeah.
To get you in there. And that's pretty much it for season one. It might sneak in a little understated way somewhere else, but that's pretty much it. And the main theme we use in that zipline scene, and I used it in a flashback at the beginning of episode 4, very briefly, when Darius and his dad are talking about the park, because it's like such an important kind of emotional moment for them. And then I use it not again until episode 7, when the kids are on the monorail, right after they sort of realize they have nothing in common and are just like on this monorail and going home. And there is like a very funny voiceover from the monorail narrator saying like, "Welcome to Jurassic Park, where everything is Jurassic," or some like ridiculous commercialized phrase. And I put it there really simply on piano. And I just thought that in the whole season, that's the spot that like it actually hits the most emotional punch, and it felt deserved. So that's sort of my thesis on that. I don't know how I'd be curious to hear like how it came across from a fan perspective.
Oh, honestly, like, and I'm not even just saying on behalf of myself, but also on behalf of like the fan community, because I've talked to a lot of different fans, including people that work for a really big Jurassic Park fan site called Jurassic Outpost, which they kind of referenced the forums for in the opening scene.
Oh, Benny. is that really like?
Yeah.
That's sweet. I love that.
Yes, that's awesome that they got the recognition, like, you know, as like a fan site. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
I think it was like really well spotted, like exactly what you say. You don't want to overdo it. Kind of like Jurassic Park 3, I love that score, but I feel like they kind of overdid the Jurassic Park themes, like, "You are watching Jurassic Park, we're gonna rebind you," you know?
Right,
like
that, right.
Kind of how it felt. But I mean, you know, I still love that score, but I think the way you did, especially like, you know, you saved, you know, the Journey to the Island theme right when they're approaching the gates. And that had to be like one of the most hair-raising and exciting uses of that theme since the
original. Oh yeah.
I'm not even joking. Oh, like, yeah. You did it so, so good.
it's fun. I mean, it's that theme really gets you jacked, and so to see the visuals of the gate opening and to, you know, I've got like some music going on, and to then like transition into that, it's a very satisfying moment. And also, like, aside from the fact that I have to like mock it up in detail, which is pretty labor intensive, you know, I don't have to write anything, so it's not that hard.
No, but you still had to orchestrate it in a way that it flowed in, like you're saying. I mean, that's, you know, not everyone can do that properly. At least I don't think so. It really takes like a unique talent. Yeah. Orchestration makes the biggest difference in the world. So I definitely think you pulled that off quite well. Like in the Underground River, like with the, you know, bioluminescence and with the enhanced parasaurs.
That's the best. Honestly, it's the best. That's the best part. That's my personal favorite. That's personally my favorite cue in the season. Everything about it. The waterfall section is really, really, the animation's beautiful. The bioluminescent parasaur offices are gorgeous and also just like a cool idea. So there was like a lot of inspiration there. And it was really fun for me because, like, I mean, you're talking about like orchestration, and that's a huge, interest, passion of mine. Like, I like the different colors of the orchestra, and I like listening to music that is really orchestrally colorful, usually from like late Romantic, early Impressionist period, if I'm listening to like classical music. So like a lot of Wagner, a lot of Strauss, a lot of Debussy, a lot of Ravel, these guys who just had like such amazing commands over all the different colors and textures and visions you can create with like a symphony orchestra. And that was one of those moments where it's actually a good segue from kind of us talking about like the very limited use of John Williams material, because one thing I often tried to do, and it also like kind of conceptually one of the first things I did in approaching the project, is you gotta kind of break down the palette of the world you're in, and like what parts of that palette you want to use to like expand the universe, and what parts you don't want to use, and what parts you kind of want to reinterpret. And there's a cue on the original soundtrack called My Friend the Brachiosaurus, which is actually two spots from the original movie that are like cut together on the soundtrack. And the first one is kind of like a more stately theme that I think is actually the scene when they're with the sick Triceratops in the first movie. And the second half of it is like when they're in the trees interacting with the Brachiosaurus, and there's this like really rich, complicated, juicy, like Impressionists, like it might as well be Debussy, like could have just ripped it out of some Debussy music, and it's amazing. And so like that's part, to me, that is part of the Jurassic palette, and this seemed like the perfect moment to do like, well, cool, I'm not gonna use that music or like even anything related to it, but like I'm gonna like, I also want to like do this Impressionist thing, because like this is the spot to do it. Like, we've got glowing dinosaurs, we're like interacting with them in this like moment of wonder, and it's also like maybe the most beautiful, you know, shots in the season. So that is kind of how I came up with that, and it turned out great. I'm really, really happy with it.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, it definitely fits within the universe of Jurassic Park's scores, you know, especially the original. And it also kind of reminded me of like when the baby Velociraptor's hatching. It kind of had that feeling too.
There's like mystique to a lot of the Jurassic Park music, where like, it's like all kind of beautiful but creepy, because like that's what genetics is, you know? It's like beautiful but creepy. And so, I think there's a lot to like take from sort of the philosophy of how the first movie in particular is scored in approaching like expanding it in this way.
I think that was what was a little surprising, and not even just within your score, but the show itself. It seemed like there was more callbacks to Jurassic Park versus Jurassic World, like even in the dialogue and the color schemes of like Camp Cretaceous.
Don't you kind of love it?
Oh, of course I do.
I think it's really cool, because even though it takes place concurrently with Jurassic World, it almost feels like Jurassic Park more.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason for that is the fact that all of our protagonists are kids. I feel like the kids in the first Jurassic Park movie had made like a little, at least for me, made like a bit more of an impression than the kids in Jurassic World, where like you're so like caught up on like Chris Pratt doing this Chris Pratt thing, which is great, that like you sort of, you don't lose the child perspective, but, and you know, child is too young a word for the characters in that movie or the original, but you know, here we kind of have this like perspective from kids, and I think it just taps into some of that wonder that we all felt in that first movie.
Yeah.
Like seeing that, because that's really kind of the genius of the movie and the genius of the score, is like I don't know, it's just those kind of moments of like wonder and innocence and like scientific questioning that I think having a bunch of kid protagonists now or teen protagonists, you can tap into that easier. And I also think it's just fun from a writing perspective to like think about the original movie and like for them to kind of borrow the tone from that.
Yeah, and it felt very real the way it all came across. And I mean, I guess like for me, the big difference with the kids in Jurassic World was that the kids were more focused on, oh no, our parents are getting a divorce. Whereas the original, it's like, we're at a dinosaur park and this is cool kind of thing. Right. So I mean, that was the chosen perspective for sure. And it's interesting because despite being an animated show, you know, with kids in mind, you know, the tone of your score and the series in general was kind of more serious than most expected. Like your music sequences match the action, like in the lagoon and the monorail sequences are, you know, really intense highlights. So like, did you score it as if you were just scoring like a live action film, like kind of disregarding like,
oh, 100%. I like, first of all, almost everything, I do a fair amount of animation, but most of the, like the Kung Fu Panda show, I do the show on Adult Swim called Tig Tone, which is totally bonkers. Like, everyone should check it out because it's like ridiculously like disturbing fantasy animation that is like way over the top musically also. But like everything, I kind of try to score everything like live action to some degree. Like animation can support a little more music and a little busier music, but I think a lot of where scoring is at, especially in things that like border on comedy in sections like a Kung Fu Panda might, like, I don't know. Like, I, to me, everything is just like a blockbuster movie, and that's how I score it. In specific to Camp Cretaceous, like kind of going back to something I was saying before, is like identifying that palette of what to take from the movie, and how one thing that I appreciate a lot from the John Williams score is how it's kind of a monster movie. And I think the creative team on the show really was tapped into that. And everyone wanted to feel like there were life and death stakes, which there are, throughout all of Camp Cretaceous. Like, this is not a kid's show. You know, I'm sure you've read, but one of the first things they told me was when they were kind of getting the final sign off from Spielberg to make this show, he said, don't make it the kiddie version. Like, this isn't Disney Jurassic Park. Like, this is like, these happen to be kids, but like, they, you know, they might get eaten. People are going to get eaten. With those scenes like the monorail, the Mosasaurus, like, I wanted to make sure that there was a risk of imminent death at any time. And John Williams had such a cool way of kind of making this like beautiful 20th century orchestral approach to that. And I think Michael did a really, really good job tapping into the monster movie vibes in Jurassic World, especially because, like, in a lot of ways, Jurassic World is more of a monster movie with the Indominus. Like, this is literally a scientific creation that has gone awry. And I think he nailed that. And, you know, Michael's score, you know, it sounds more appropriate for a 2015 studio movie than just a pure redo of the 1993 like aesthetic would have been, and I think he totally crushed that. So for me, I kind of had to, you know, say, okay, now it's 2020, you know, how are we, like, the audience needs to like feel the exhilaration of the scoring in a contemporary way, and I want to make sure I get the vibe that like Michael nailed and that John Williams nailed, going all the way back to 93. And so, yeah, I don't know, it's kind of just like a long freeform answer to your question, but those scenes like that became these like big monster movie type sequences, like set pieces. You know, most of the episodes sort of have a set piece, which makes for a very cinematic experience. Or like I like to joke to the creators, like, every week I have to write the climax of Jurassic World. Like,
yeah,
I'm not tired at all.
Oh, that's so cool. I mean, you definitely had a lot of toys to play with, just as, you know, just the show did. I mean, that, if I had one criticism with the original Jurassic World movie, was that there was a lot of things introduced, like the monorail, and even things like on the park map, if you ever saw it. Like, I think they even have like the zip line mentioned, maybe.
Right.
And all these different toys that, you know, we all wanted to see be played with, but, you know, there's only so much time in the movie with the story that they're trying to tell. So, of course, they can't have every cool sequence right. happen. So now you get to play with those toys.
Exactly. And I think one of the things about Jurassic Park as like a setting that gets people so excited is everyone wants to just like brainstorm what that park could be like. Because like everyone just wishes Jurassic Park, Jurassic World were a real thing, despite all the warning signs we get from the movies. Like, I know I wish I could go. And so then, yeah. like, you know, once you think that, you start to think like, oh, wouldn't it be so cool if there were zip line? Or like, oh, I bet a monorail would be so cool. Or like, what's the Jungle Cruise equivalent in Jurassic World? Like,
oh yes,
you know, it's pretty much an endless funnel for creativity. And so, yeah, I think one of the most exciting parts about working on the show is that I get to explore those things and score them when, like, no one's gotten to before. I feel like there was, like, was there a monorail, like, in the books, or did they mention it in the first movie and just never, like, I feel like everyone has wanted a monorail forever and now it finally, like, exists. I guess you see it a little bit in Jurassic World in that kind of park montage.
Yeah, you see parts of it in the movie. But, you know, believe it or not, the monorail, the idea of the monorail might have originally come from in the game Trespassers for the PC. And there's like ruins of a monorail that was trying to be built on Isla Sorna. So like maybe they saw that idea and decided to put it in Jurassic World. Or maybe they just, you know, thought, oh, well, Disneyland's got a monorail. So maybe
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I love the idea of the monorail. I love that entire episode, I think, is like a really strong point kind of for everyone's character arc. You know, like, yes, there's dinosaurs, but like one of the great parts about the show, I think, is like the character arcs for all the kids end up being like pretty strong and relatable. And I think when, you know, they're kind of introduced as a series of stereotypes as a starting point, and then like from episode 4 through 8, you just get to watch everyone like really put under stress and evolve and reveal a lot about their backstories. And I just think that's awesome. Like, that's the kind of stuff as a film composer that like you're always keeping track of, because, you know, I'm constantly scoring what's not on the screen, whether it's a threat or like an emotional breakthrough or what. And so that monorail, that episode 7, it is kind of gave me this huge opportunity during the sequence of the monorail to like play along with all the beats as the kids are discovering that they might not actually really be friends, and then score that set piece of set pieces with the with the pteranods, which is like nuts,
with a dramatic ending to it as well.
Very dramatic ending, you know, some serious life or death stakes. That is probably my favorite spots are the bioluminescent cave, the Mosasaurus lagoon. So that episode 6 is stacked. And then episode 7, the train sequence, which is basically like 8 straight minutes of mayhem action music that also does a lot of storytelling. You know, there's like a theme that I established back in episode 2 when Ben is holding Bumpy right after Bumpy hatches. And like, that is the theme that you will hear when Ben is like up on top of the monorail climbing to the front car. And like, it sounds totally different, but like, that's where it came from. And so like, it sequences like that really provide kind of the final form of evolving your themes, you know, when you're like working with these characters over the course of like a season. And so it's really fun because, like, on one hand, you're just, like, scoring the awesome set piece that is, like, a monorail being attacked by flying dinosaurs. But, like, if you aren't, like, to really do it well, you gotta, like, hit the themes right in a way that packs the subliminal emotional punch. And so I feel like I did a pretty good job there. I feel great about it. It was a really fun sequence to do.
No, it came out spectacularly. Like I mentioned before, that whole episode basically was one of the musical highlights of the entire series. And it was just exciting, and yet, you know, had the emotional beats as well, you know, just like any good movie would, you know, like a little mini movie. If there is a second season, how would you tackle the score, given that now the park is torn apart, you know, with the kids abandoned there? Like, would you maybe harken back references to John Williams' Lost World score with like percussive elements, because, you know, everything's wild?
Maybe there's I always like percussion. There's you know, it's there's a lot of colors in percussion that, yeah, some of those Lost World sequences are have a lot of percussion going on. You know, I think for me, it's all about the characters ultimately. So, you know, I'm sure if the kids are stuck there, there's going to be a lot of new dinosaurs that provide new visuals that would be fun to score. But, you know, those the stories of the individual characters are still going on. So that provides a lot of kind of emotional meat to thread, you know, seeing how they all kind of develop.
Yeah, and we have Manticore to worry about. So, I mean,
we got Manticore. Yeah, that is a bit of a cliffhanger back from episode 2, you know. It comes up a few more times, but not a lot of resolution in season 1 with that.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely got people curious and invested to know, like, what happens next with that, and hopefully, you know, that provides you with more, you know, musical ideas too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I love the ideas of, like, bad evil corporations. They, you know, that always provides a lot of good versus evil scoring material.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, that's something that, you know, they officially announced, like, with the Jurassic World Dominion, like the reintroduction of Dodson.
Right.
Who is Dodson? And
I read about that. We got Dodson here.
Yeah. So that's pretty exciting. Nice hat.
Yeah. Well, honestly, like, that might be my favorite scene from the original movie. It's iconic.
Well, you know, it's funny, and I don't know how intentional this was, but the girl that was the spy for Manticore, Sammy, you know, she's wearing, like, this floral shirt that's very similar to the one Nedry wears.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Like, they're both spies. Like, that was
the
giveaway.
It, yeah. Basically, beware of anyone wearing Hawaiian prints.
Exactly. Never trust them.
That's the big lesson to take from Camp Cretaceous.
That's pretty exciting, though. Definitely a lot of, you know, more toys to play with in season 2, you know, if the chance comes.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully there is. I mean, it was, you know, in the top 10 of Netflix, you know, right away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this show, I'm pretty ecstatic about where it's sitting on the rankings right now. I honestly was. I mean, Jurassic Park is a huge property, so you hope it does well. But you never know when something comes out, like how it's actually going to get received and what kind of legs it's going to have, and like what, you know. I'm sure there are a lot of kids like me when I was a kid who would probably just rewatch this on repeat, like, you know, again and again and again. I'm sure there's people who have, like, seen it 6 times already. So that always helps, but, like, I to see that as, like, number 2 the day after it came out was, like, so thrilling. And it's basically just been there since then. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, just the kind of the joy of knowing that so many people have heard your work in this, you know, fantastic show is just, I'm sure that's gratifying for you.
Oh, it feels amazing. I don't know. It's just cool to kind of, like, give something to the universe like that and have it actually be, like, well received.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've, you know, the fan community, and I'm sure even you as a kid, just as well as I, wanted a show like this since the beginning, you know.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
We wish we could have grown up with a show like this. So now it's finally here. You know, even as adults, it's still fun to watch. But, you know, as a kid, I can only imagine how fun it must be.
Oh, my God. It's got to be the most amazing thing ever.
Yeah. Like, what are the types of scoring projects that interest you the most? And are there any in your near future, even apart from, you know, Jurassic World?
Well, I mean, like I said, I kind of like to score everything like it's a big blockbuster movie. And that's because, like, that's kind of my jam. Right now, I think what's cool about the entertainment industry is, like, you've got a lot of the split between, like, big screen and small screen has kind of, like, gone away, and suddenly you have, like, Jurassic Park TV shows and, like, shows that, you know, because of changes to budgets and how much things cost and whatnot, suddenly you can have, like, a Netflix show or limited series that looks amazing and can have, like, a huge cinematic score, and there's a lot of opportunity there to, like, tell a lot of stories. And I think those kinds of, I guess I'm excited that those types of cinematic stories, like, don't necessarily need to just be, like, the 50 big movies that come out every year. There's, like, a lot more opportunity there, because, like, I think, like, look, I wanted to be Steven Spielberg when I was five. Like, I like movies. I like telling stories on like a movie level. I think one reason why I like enjoyed doing Jurassic World Camp Cretaceous so much is that like it's really just a 2.5 hour movie, you know, if you watch them back. Like, it flows like a movie. I was keeping that in mind constantly, you know, keeping track of the arc beyond the episodic, like the individual episodic arcs. And for whatever reason, most of the projects I do end up being that, basically. Like, like very cinematic. One of my other big projects, also on Netflix right now, is Cobra Kai. And that, I mean, the score to that is like wildly cinematic, with a very different flavor than Camp Cretaceous, but still, like, we score that like a movie, is what we're constantly talking about. Like, there's no, I feel like there's kind of this definition of, like, TV music that used to exist, and that, like, is kind of fading a little bit, but, like, I never want to do that. Like, whether I'm doing a TV show or a movie, like, I'm writing movie music. Like, this cinema, like, the theatricality of it is very important to me, the sort of like cinematic storytelling components and scope of it is very important to me. That Adult Swim show I mentioned before, Tig Tone, is also ridiculously cinematic. It's kind of like a big over the top Lord of the Rings thing.
Oh, nice.
And so it's just, the music is huge and so fun, and there's all these themes that get developed, even though it's like a totally manic fantasy trope. Like, joke. I also do the show Pen 15 on Hulu, which the second season just came out, and it's very cinematic in a different way. There's lots of set pieces. It's shot very stylishly. If you aren't familiar with that show, it is this totally on the surface crazy like story about adolescence, where the two lead actresses are in their 30s, but they're playing 13-year-old versions of themselves, and everyone else in the show is 13 years old. so it's kind of this like crazy surrealist experiment, but by like the third episode, you've totally forgotten that they are 30 something years old.
Wow.
And you're just like deep in this like adolescent experience with them, and like the music is like a huge part of that. And then in the second season just came out like a week ago, and I had so much fun doing these like, they are a very different kind of cinematic than like the monorail attack in Camp Cretaceous. But like, I think for me, it all comes from this like same storytelling place. And like, that's what I'm really into.
Do you have a favorite dinosaur?
Oh man. Let me think. Did I have a favorite dinosaur like back in my real dinosaur heyday?
Yeah.
It's different from now. And I don't know. I mean, I think as a kid, I was like pretty into the Velociraptors, because like,
yes.
They got a lot of personality. They're like, they're just kind of awesome. But like, I don't know. I kind of like Triceratops a lot. I had a pretty cool Triceratops toy when I was a kid. It was red and that I loved to play with. And so like, I feel like that one's pretty close to home. In Camp Cretaceous, I really like what they did with Sinoceratops. I think is super sweet. And in episode 3, when that was a really fun sequence to do too, when they're in the gyrosphere chasing after it and it's kind of all fun and games for a bit, was really fun. And then there's like a really short 10-second little moment of music when Darius and Brooklyn like corner it in the forest and like get out of the gyrosphere to like try to get it. It's this really short moment, and I've always like really liked it, so therefore I'm very attached to the Sinoceratops because of that little score moment. Maybe like Triceratops, Sinoceratops.
No, that's pretty cool. Can we expect a digital release of the score? And if you're not sure, like, what can us as fans do try to make that happen? What do we have to do?
I feel like it probably will happen eventually, but I don't know. You know what you could do is everyone could just tweet a lot at DreamWorks Animation and Amblin and Backlot Music. Backlot Music is like the record label that Universal owns, and so it's like all those companies are connected. And so like, hey, if you just tweeted them a whole lot or hit them up on Instagram and just ask like, hey, can we get the score to Camp Cretaceous? Like, maybe it'll happen. I love that, the fan uprising.
That's, yeah, that's how we get things done. Well, thank you very much, Leo, for, you know, taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, of course. It's a total pleasure to talk to fans of the show and, you know, who really care about, you know, the musical universe that I got to kind of join and help expand. And I feel very honored to be a part of the Jurassic Park franchise. And so it's like really important to me that like fans of the franchise are like stoked about what I did and not being like, oh man, what a stinker. Like that was a, you know, low effort thing. Cause like, I really wanted it to feel, not that it was just like more Jurassic Park music, but like a natural extension of the world. Like that was my whole goal. And so to hear that like people are enthusiastic about it then makes me like 10 times as enthusiastic about it. So yeah, it means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, we, you know, we definitely do think it worked, and you know, we want you back for the next one. So definitely.
All right. Well, I can tell you if there's more, I'll definitely be back for the next one.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you again. Yeah, definitely was great talking with you.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Jurassic Time would like to thank Leo Bierenberg for his enthusiastic time spent with us. His immense talents helped shape a thrilling new score for the Jurassic franchise, with hopefully more on the horizon. We hope you have enjoyed this conversation, and remember to tweet or reach out to the aforementioned handles to support the release of this score. Be sure to like and subscribe to see more of Jurassic Time's exploration of Jurassic Park's hidden histories.